This morning in the book of Judges, I can tell you that there are characters that are more fun to preach on than who we're going to preach on this morning. In fact, if I just think through the Bible, it's a whole lot more fun preaching on the Joseph and the Daniels than it is to preach on Samson. And Samson is our character for the day. I read this book, and I will tell you that I understand, or I think I understand, why God saved it for us. And there's some incredible implications that are very, very helpful. And when you go home today, I think you'll be glad you study this text. But I want to tell you this, it's sad. Reading the story of Samson is just sad. We have themed this little study through the book of Judges. We've themed it, how to ruin your life. Because it just keeps giving living models of how you ruin it. And over it's happened. We talked in week number one, you ruin your life by embracing the culture. We talked in week number two, you ruin your life by always taking the safe route. Week number three, we talked about you ruin your life by living in the past. And week number four, the one we're on now, is you ruin your life by being blinded by your strength. And ultimately, that's what takes place. A man who's blinded by his strength. A man who's crippled by his strength. We're going to go through this, some of the chapters. I'm not going to go through all the details of Samson's life, but I want to read a number of the verses and let you get a feel for it. Judges chapter 13, I want to start with the second verse. And a certain man of Zorah named Manoah from the clan of the Danites had a wife who was sterile and remained childless. And the angel of the Lord appeared to her and said, "You are sterile and childless, but you're going to conceive and have a son. Now see to it that you drink no wine or other fermented drink, and that you do not eat anything unclean, because you will conceive and give birth to a son. No razor may be used on his head, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth, and he will begin the deliverance of Israel from the hands of the Philistines." Angel shows up and says, your son is going to bring about something in keeping the Philistines, this is the enemy territory, to keep them off the Israelites. Your son will be a Nazarite. That word Nazarite, it is a symbolic phrase. It refers to some symbolism in being somebody's life. Ultimately, it means fully dedicated to the Lord. And in the same way that we might fast from food, the Nazarites fasted from a number of things, but they were visual reminders, your life's given to the Lord. Now, I don't mind telling you, when I read this text, I think, wow, God's going to raise up a godly, wonderful man with incredible ability and a great heart to serve him. I'm really pretty excited. I even like how the rest of the chapter kind of goes. Come on down to verse 24. And the woman gave birth to a boy, and she named him Samson. And he grew, and the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him. And going, wow, I like this. Chapter 14, I don't like as well. Chapter 14. And Samson went down to Timnah, and he saw there a young Philistine woman. Timnah is just one of the Philistine towns. And when he returned, he said to his father and mother, "I have seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife." His father and mother replied, "Isn't there an acceptable woman among all the tribes or the nation of Israel, among our people? Must you go to the uncircumcised Philistines to get a wife to the unbelievers?" But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me. She's the right one for me." Or implication even a little more, she looks good to me. Verse 4, his parents did not know that this was from the Lord, who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines, for at that time they were ruling over Israel. I hit a problem. My problem is this. Here's a guy who was dedicated to the Lord and given to the Lord in the previous chapter, and then I find that he violates the most basic principle, which is you choose within your family the household of faith. So I got a problem with the violation, and then I find I got another verse that throws me for a loop. His parents did not know this was from the Lord. Now, does God sanctify moral disobedience? I think when you hit a passage where you don't know what it means, you always start with a passage that you do know what it means. Let me start with one. James chapter 1, God's not evil, and God doesn't tempt anyone with evil. Let no one say when I'm tempted, boy, God tempted me. Spirit of God came on me and I had an affair. No, that'll never happen. Spirit of God came on me and I decided to embezzle. No, that won't happen. Not in that sense. So what does this mean? For his parents did not know this was of the Lord. I think you have to sort through and recognize that if God does not send temptation, is it possible this passage, and probably is, that this passage means they did not know the Lord would use this. God in his foreknowledge will use things that were not his will. God in his foreknowledge will use both the fool and the wise man. And the fool, he will put at an intersection where he needs and can use. I think you have to start off with this passage. Do not hang the immorality of Samson upon the nature and the heart of God. That would be a violation of everything I understand from Genesis to Revelation. So the passages I don't understand have to be defined by the passages that I think I do. Let's go to chapter 15. By the way, there's all kinds of things that take place in chapter 14. Chapter 15, I'm jumping in the middle of the context. Verse 3, Samson said to them, "This time I have a right to get even with the Philistines. I'll really harm them." So he went out and caught 300 foxes and tied them tail to tail in pairs. He then fastened a torch to each pair of tails. He lit the torches and let the foxes loose in the standing grain of the Philistines. He burned up the shocks and standing grain together with the vineyards and olive groves. You've seen in California what one kid can do if he wants to be malicious with a lighter out there. Try 150 wild sets of animals running, dragging torches across the land. I mean, everywhere you look, there would have been a burn going everywhere. It would have been Black Friday on Wall Street their entire economy would have taken a radical hit. And God uses this rather bizarre character somehow to inflict damage on the Philistines. Let's go to chapter 16, verse 1. One day Samson went to Gaza, where he saw a prostitute, and he went in to spend the night with her. And the people of Gaza were told, "Samson is here." So they surrounded the place, and they lay in wait for him all night at the city gate. They made no move during the night, saying, "At dawn we'll kill him." But Samson lay there only until the middle of the night. Then he got up and took hold of the doors of the city gate, together with the two posts, and he tore them loose, bar and all. And he lifted them to his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. Most commentaries say he carried him 30 miles. Chapter 16, verses 21 and following. Then the Philistines seized him, gouged out his eyes, and took him down to Gaza. And binding him with bronze shackles, they set him to grinding in the prison. But the hair on his head began to grow again after he'd been shaved. Now the rulers of the Philistines assembled to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to celebrate, saying, "Our God has delivered Samson, our enemy, into our hands." And when the people saw him, they praised their god, saying, "Our God has delivered our enemy into our hands, the one who laid waste to our land and multiplied our slain. And while they were in high spirits, they shouted, "Bring out Samson to entertain us." So they called Samson out of the prison, and he performed for them. And when they stood him among the pillars, Samson said to the servant who held his hands, "Put me where I can feel the pillars that support the temple, so I may lean against them." Now the temple was crowded with men and women, and all the rulers of the Philistines were there. And on the roof were about 3,000 men and women watching Samson perform. Then Samson prayed to the Lord, "O sovereign Lord, remember me, O God. Please strengthen me just one more time, and let me with one blow get revenge on the Philistines for my two eyes." Then Samson reached toward the two central pillars on which the temple stood, bracing himself against them, his right hand on the one, his left hand on the other. Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." Then he pushed with all his might, and down came the temple on the rulers and all the people in it. Thus he killed many more when he died than while he lived. And his family came and got it. I'm going to start with a couple of questions. I mean, I just have to. They just hang out there, and I have to go by them. The first question is this: will we see Samson in heaven? Is this a story of a very immature man? But there is a saving seed of faith somewhere in there. Is this a story of a man who was very immature, but somehow he was humbled at the end of his life? He's a blind guy and in the prison, and he has a turnaround, and God reads, and the God who's the gracious God redeems this man, and you'll see him in heaven? Or is this the story of a fool on his way to hell, a fool that God uses and just tells his story? The answer is, I don't know. I would be a little careful about automatically hanging one way or the other where you go with Samson. I know he's mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 among those of faith. And yet, when I read that chapter of Hebrews chapter 11, it's people who God partnered with and did astounding things with. I don't necessarily know that Samson had saving faith. There's a difference in this thing. I don't know. I don't know. I recognize the scripture primarily lists degenerate things he did, and yet how God took and still used him. Funny thing about heaven, let's just take it on a little aside here. I think there'll be three surprises we have in heaven. I'm pretty confident you'll agree with me. I think the first surprise we'll have in heaven is who's there. I think we will be astounded at how deep and wide grace was. We'll be surprised who's there. I think the second surprise in heaven is who's not there. Well, I saw them cast out demons and prophesy and do all kinds of things. I mean, in Matthew chapter 7. And yet, no. You understand, you're not saved by your works, you're saved by grace. And you never accepted grace. I think we'll be surprised who's there. I think we'll be surprised who's not there. And then I think here's the ultimate surprise. I think we'll be surprised we're there. Because when you actually see the holiness of God and actually see what God's nature is like, for the first time, you'll understand how deep and wide the grace of God was. I don't know what to do with Samson. Ultimately, human eyes aren't privy to what the eyes of God are. I have to finish at this. I don't know whether this is a saved man. I can say this. I don't want to live a life like his. The second question that I have is a little more specific, and I can kind of find an answer maybe a little better for it. The second question is, because this degenerate life that is listed, at least in the events that he does, what does it mean the Spirit of God came on him? What's that mean? The Spirit of God came on him. That says over and over again, repeated, and the Spirit of God came on him. Well, let me summarize something that I think has been helpful for me, and you can decide whether it is for you or not. I went through the Old Testament and studied as hard as I could, what's it mean when the Spirit of God comes on someone? And I found that in every context, when the Spirit of God came on someone, let's say almost everyone, it was clear, every context, one of four things is meant when the Spirit of God comes on somebody. Just read the context. It'll always be one of these four. Number one, when the Spirit of God comes on someone, you may be looking for your donkeys, but when the Spirit of God comes on you, you begin to worship, and you'll just begin to suddenly recognize you're in the presence of God, and you'll join the praise band, for lack of better words. That's what Saul does, worship. And so when the Spirit of God comes upon individuals, you'll notice worship breaks out. On other occasions, when the Spirit of God comes on someone, suddenly they recognize their own unholiness and this brokenness. Real repentance, real brokenness, a real sense of woe is me. So sometimes it's worship, sometimes it's brokenness. The third thing that you'll recognize, and by the way, I know these all are tied together in many ways, but the third one you'll notice is they will pick up the agenda of God. It's somebody who's taking care of the things of life, but the Spirit of God comes on them and they suddenly drop everything they were doing that morning, starting at 8 in the morning, and they just go pick up what is the agenda of God. I care about the things God cares about. And so you'll find a prophet who will walk away from what he's been doing because this is what he's going to go say to the king, the agenda of God. Or here's the fourth one. When the Spirit of God comes on somebody, there's power. There's real gifting of something they couldn't do before, and there's real power. For example, the first place in the Old Testament ever says the Spirit of God came upon somebody is in relation to craftsmen who the Spirit of God came on, and they became skilled with their hands and are making items for the tabernacle. This guy made a B- in junior high shop, and the next thing you know, the Spirit of God comes on him, and he's incredible in what he can do. I mean, that kind of an idea. Now, if those are the four that we find in the Old Testament, let's go through who's Samson and what happens here. Well, when the Spirit of God comes on him, do you see him worship? Not once. Spirit of God comes on him and you see him broken and humbled? Not once. Spirit of God comes on him and he picks up the agenda of God. Nope. In fact, every time he's ticked about something that happened to him or people he knows, when the Spirit of God comes on him, what's he pick up? City gates, carries him 30 miles. God will gift who he chooses to gift, both fools and wise men. Do not automatically assume that God is limited in who he can give gifting to. Let's go to a couple of observations about the text. Number one, oh, by the way, this is an aside. Just, you want to know the neat thing that I love about the New Testament? In the Old Testament, it's almost always one of the four. In the New Testament, when the Spirit of God is given to an individual, it's always the four. It's worship and brokenness and the agenda of God and gifting. You're going to notice those are spoken interchangeably throughout the New Testament. That's what it means when the Spirit of God comes. So those of you who live in the Spirit, what will you have? Worship and brokenness and the agenda and gifts. Two observations about the text here. Number one, I look at his life, his incredible ability, this unfettered life to do whatever he wants. Who can stop him? I look at this unfettered life and I realize it's incredibly dangerous when you can do what you want. Let's just start with that one. It's incredibly dangerous when you can do what you want. You see, it's not what comes from outside of us that is our greatest threat. It's from what's inside our greatest threat. The things that will most disrupt your life and most tear up your life will not be the cancers or the heart attacks. It won't even be a premature death or anything else. It won't be famine or loss of jobs. The things that will most destroy your life probably will never come from outside of you. The things that are most destructive are from the inside. Turn, if you would, to the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah, we're going to start in the 17th chapter of the book of Jeremiah. It's a passage many of you have highlighted. If not, you need to know where this passage is, and you need to circle it, because it is a great warning bell going off just constantly in Scripture. Jeremiah 17. I want to start with the fifth verse. That's where I'm going to start in Jeremiah 17. I'm just going to read, in fact, I'm going to read a little bit of a length of passage here in Jeremiah 17, then we'll go to Jeremiah chapter 9 after that. This is what the Lord says. Cursed is the one who trusts in man. You trust man? And by the way, he's not talking about another man. He's talking about this man. Cursed is the one who trusts in man, who depends on flesh for his strength. Verse 6, he'll be like a scrub brush in the wasteland. He will not see prosperity when it comes. He will dwell in the parched place of the desert, in a salt land where no one lives. Oh, you'll still be alive, but you're just a desert bush. Verse 7, but blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose confidence is in him. He'll be like a tree planted by the water that sends out its roots by the stream. It does not fear when heat comes. Its leaves are always green. It has no worries in a year of drought and never fails to bear fruit. And here's the verse. The heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? Flip back, if you would, Jeremiah chapter 9, verse 23, 24. This is what the Lord says. Let not the wise man boast in his wisdom, or the strong man boast of his strength, or the rich man boast of his riches. I don't care how gifted you are, how talented you are. I don't know what blessings God has given you. Don't you dare trust them. Not in that sense. Verse 24, but let him who boasts boast of this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord, who, and it goes on to the text. I watched the sins of Gideon. I watched the sins of Samson and David and Judah and Peter. And I recognize, as I'm studying Samson in particular, no one has a heart good enough just to follow it. No one. When you can do what you want, and you just begin to follow your heart, there's always this devastating story that follows. Even if I'm incredibly blessed by God and I have a spiritual heritage and spiritual gifts and great knowledge and pleasing talents and all those sort of things, my greatest danger will always be my own heart. In itself, I don't think there's any such thing as a good heart. I think the only thing a heart can ever be is submitted to the Lord, and He's the master of my heart, and I make it knuckle under, or my heart is self-seducing. But I don't think there is such a thing as a good heart. I think there's only a submitted heart or a self-seducing one. J.R. Tolkien, the author of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and those things, J.R. Tolkien has a character named Gollum who is always at the edge of the hero's life. Gollum is this deceptive, slimy creature who's always at the edge. Now, Tolkien claims that he didn't like analogies and allegories. In fact, he says he didn't want people trying to put details to what he wrote, although he himself wrote an awful lot of men there. And there's a couple of them in particular he identifies. It's funny, but he is reported to have said of all the characters that he nailed down, this is the one, it was Gollum was the one he identified. Well, who is this slimy creature who's always close to the hero's life? And J.R. Tolkien said, it's always our own heart. That Gollum, this slimy, self-serving creature, is always what Randy has to keep one eye open watching. And it's not out there, it's in here. The stories of the Jimmy Swaggerts and the Bakers and all of those sort of things of the television evangelists, they're not odd stories. There are stories of people in this room who you've cried and wept at night and couldn't figure out, why do I do it again? Why does that happen? And you beat yourself and say, stupid, 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 why did I do it again? I have spiritual heritage, I have spiritual gifts, I know things. Why? Because when you're allowed to do what you want, you'll always be shocked by what you want. What you want will destroy you. And here's a man, unfettered, not held back by anything, not even his submission to God. And it's one degrading story after another. You go through his list of specifics. Incredibly gifted. A clear, definite purpose established for his life. But the godly admonition about a wife, he ignores it. Godly admonition about sexual purity, he ignores it. Dedication vows to what it means to be a Nazarite, breaks those vows like they're glass. He is mastered by nothing on the outside. He's only mastered by what's in the inside. If you would say to me, Randy, I confess I don't always remember your sermons. Please know, I'm just like you. I don't either. Someone will say, you know, that sermon 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I have to confess, boy, I'm just struggling like crazy on occasions, you know. I think that's how kind of life is a little bit. But every now and then, there's a sermon by somebody that it grips you, and the years, it hangs on to you, and the years are like they're nothing. It was over 30 years ago, I heard a sermon by Tom Lawson. Look at Tom Lawson. Gene Barron. So I was getting ready to say, Tom. 30 years ago, a sermon by Gene Barron. I remember where I was sitting at. I know where I was. I walked in. I mean, I was a friend of Gene's. I don't know that I had any particular thing that set me up for it. I just know Gene Barron preached a sermon that 30 plus years later, it's like it happened last week. In that sermon, Gene Barron hit a spiritual truth and hit it as well as I've ever heard it. It was a sermon on freedom. He said, most of us believe that freedom is the opportunity to do what you want. And we just want to be free. And he went through all the kinds of cultural things. I just want to be free. I wouldn't do anything bad with it. Don't misunderstand me, but I just want to be free. I want to be able to just do what I want. And Gene began to just logically walk through a process. And that logical process he walked through is freedom is never the opportunity to do what you want. Because here's what will always happen. And he begins to describe, he said, watch the fish strain in vain as it pulls on the hook. Because the fish was free to do what it wanted with a juicy worm. And because it was free to do what it wanted, it was free to make that first choice, but you're not free once you make the first choice. Once you make the first choice, there is no more freedom. Watch the coyote gnaw at the trap, gnaw at its own leg, fight against it, and jump back. That coyote pursued what it wanted. The bait looked so good. It seemed so appetizing. And you're free to do what you want. But you're free to make the first choice only, but you're not free after that. And so the man whose lust has him licked, who just takes moments every now and then that he just lets himself do what he wants, and he's free to make the first choice, but not after that. And he weeps, and he beats his own self, going, why? And his own kids are destroyed, and his wife is brokenhearted and devastated, and his life lives in chaos. Why? Because freedom is never what we define it as. Jean Barron switched it around and said, freedom is always just the opportunity to choose your responsibility. That's all freedom is. You get the opportunity to choose your responsibility, or to use it in biblical terms, you get to choose your master. Freedom is nothing more than the right to choose your own master. In the book of Romans, Paul writes and says, don't you understand when you serve sin, you become a slave to sin, and sin becomes your master? Do you understand when you serve God, you can't follow your own heart? Your own heart will enslave you. When you follow the Lord, all you've done is you've said, I shall make Him the master of my heart. So who's really free? The man who can't resist the woman who throws herself at him, and he can't say no because his own appetites are allowed to run loose, or the man who can say no under any circumstance that's thrown at him because of this answer. You know, if it was only me, I'm sure I would do this. But it's not only me. I submit to Him. And His heart I submit to. And the submission to His heart is the only thing that controls my heart. And if I can't submit to His heart, my heart will take me here. Always. So I'm reading this text this week about Samson, and it stops being about Samson. Stop being about Samson about halfway through. And it starts going, Randy, I don't care what spiritual gifts you have. I don't care what opportunities. You can't live life without understanding how dangerous it is to do what you want, because the heart is the golem I'll always fight. And so in this text, I say to those of you who are struggling with bitterness and anger, resentment, and crippling depression, how'd you get there? Please know it was not imposed on you from the outside. You may serve the Lord in many ways and know many, many good things, but if you follow your own heart on its own inclinations, you will end up having a Samson kind of experience. Your own heart. We are free to choose the master we'll serve. And the funny thing is, the guy who serves the master, that man has wife and children that hold him as honorable and noble and godly and right. That's the man whose children can be proud of him and grandchildren. That's the individual. And you suddenly look at this great provision of the master we serve, life and life abundantly. I think there's some things in Samson's life to wrestle with that. Let me make the second observation. It doesn't take as long, but it may be the most important one I make. The second observation, I think, is extremely critical for this story to make sense. I would make the second observation this way, that God will use any man or woman, whether they are knowingly or unknowingly a part of His plan, He'll still use them. God in His sovereign hand will use any man or woman, knowingly, wittingly, or unwittingly. God will still use them to accomplish His plan. I need you to visually sort of work through this a little bit. The nation of Israel, and I know I'm making some of you in the front rows, I apologize for making you have to turn your head around here a little bit, but I need a kind of a visual. Nothing against you guys personally, but you're the Philistines, okay? You look kind of Philistine-y to me. I mean, just. But you're the Philistines, and you dominate this room. You control it. You dominate it. You spiritually are destroying it. You're the Philistines. You're the people of God. and you're failing miserable. You have acted more like the Philistines. You have compromised your own holiness. In fact, it is so degrading that even when women would come to bring offerings to the Lord at the tabernacle, the priests are having sex with them. It's incredibly corrupt culture. And in the middle of that, what's God going to do? The answer is there are two little boys born at the same time, almost the same time. Two little boys. The two little boys that are born at almost the same time, one of them we've been talking about, Samson. There's another little boy, you won't even know his name for a few more chapters. He grows up right over here in this corner. He grows up surrounded by falsehood and grows up surrounded by hypocrisy. He grows up in a degradation culture. And yet this little boy has a heart that God will nurture and bring about. And this little boy gives his heart to the Lord in pure ways. And God will use that little boy to bring about a national revival. Samuel is his name. And Samuel will turn this whole crowd around. You guys will have a changed heart because of the presence of Samuel. Well, how does God protect that little boy over here? And how does God partner with him so there's any kind of nurturing or nesting where this Samuel can grow up protected? The answer is God will put a big dumb brute named Samson right in the middle between him and the Philistines. And the Philistines will beat themselves against this big dumb brute named Samson left and right. And Samson will wreak havoc on them. He is the distraction. He captures the eyes of the Philistines. And in a little bit of safety and security, Samuel grows up. And a godly man turns the world around. The story of Samson was never the story of Samson. It was always the story of Samuel. It was always about God's divine hand in another place. Samson's the wall. He's the western wall of protection. Why does that matter? Because some of you come from very, very hard backgrounds and very, very difficult circumstances, and the Christian life feels so alone. Like it's, I don't know how to handle this. My whole family was so pagan. Life is so hard. I don't know how you have a heart for God. The answer is, it's never a solitary journey. At the end of the life, you're going to find that God placed, well, that neighbor who moved in across the street, that wasn't a random buy. That teacher you had in fifth grade, that was not too accidental. What occurred is God continually raised up some people wittingly and knowingly and other people unwittingly and unknowingly. But God's great surprise to us in heaven, I think, will be this one as well. How I nurtured you and looked after you and protected you, and I raised up both fools and wise men that I might partner with you. The divine partnership. This book that talks about Samson reminds me I will never be in a circumstance that God abandons me without the Spirit of God moving in ways to protect this heart. This morning, I have no other particular conclusion than this. It comes down to this. Guard your heart. It's the wellspring of your life. Guard it, and the only way you can guard it is make it knuckle under and surrender to the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. His heart is good. Yours will never be. Make your heart submit to His. And here's the second. When you do that, you'll be shocked at the western wall God raises up regularly in ways you would have never known to bring about His purposes in His kingdom. The sovereign hand of God. May God, may you do it again in us. Would you stand as we sing?